Welcome to the Sagebrush Turf, stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Wydell, reading Delilah of the Snow by Harold Bidwell. Chapter 16, An Invalid Record. Supper had just been finished, and Ingleby was lying pipe in hand beside the creek, waiting until Ledger should bring another load of wash dirt from the mine. The sunlight was still pleasantly warm, the air filled with the balsamic odors of the pines, and there was a little smile of unalloyed content in Ingleby's face as he drank them in. Though he had toiled since morning, those few minutes would be the only rest he would enjoy until long after darkness closed in, and once more he indulged in visions of a roseate future, as he made the most of them. They had washed up each bucket load as they brought it to the surface, and the result had made the richness of the mine increasingly plain. Ingleby was getting accustomed to the fact that he was now, in all probability, at least, comparatively rich, and already his brain was occupied with half-formed projects. They did not include a further course of prospecting, for he had discovered that placer mines are addicted to playing out with disconcerting rapidity, and that in case of the deep lodes it is not, as a rule, the man who records the claim, but the capitalist or company jobber who takes the profit. He would go back to civilization and embark on an industrial career, for there was, he fancied, not altogether incorrectly, wealth awaiting the resolute and enterprising man with sufficient money who was willing to play his part in laying the foundations of the future prosperity of that rich land, and he had a young man's faith in his abilities, which was in his case more or less warranted. Then, when he had won a footing, he would boldly ask Major Colthurst for his daughter's hand. Social distinctions count for little in Western Canada, and though the waiting would be hard, there was consolation in the thought that every bold venture would bring him so much nearer her. Ingleby was proud and content to possess his soul in patience until he had shown that he could hold his own with his fellows and hew his own way to fortune. It was at least a wholesome resolution, and there was behind it a vague participation in the belief held by primitive peoples and proclaimed in courts in the days of chivalry, that man, before he mated, should be required to make his manhood plain by deeds accomplished and pain endured. It was not fitting, he felt, that the woman should give everything or stoop too far. He must have something to offer, as well as the ability to lift himself to her level. And through all there ran the desire of the democratic Englishman for an opportunity to prove himself at least the equal of those accounted his betters. Before Ledger reached him with the bucket, there was a rustling in the tall fern behind him, and Tomlinson came out upon the bank of the creek. He glanced at the little flag above the mine and the pile of debris at the water's edge, and then took up the pan Ingleby had laid down and dipped it in the stream. A whirl of it in his practiced hand was enough for him. "Yes," he said quietly, "I guess you've struck it rich." Ingleby laughed and handed him a little bag. "I almost think we have, feel that," he said. Tomlinson poised the bag in one hand, and then sat down with a little gesture of assent, for he was not by any means a demonstrative man. "Well," he said, "it will make it easier for Hetty, and I'm glad of it. Slaving away at that bakery isn't the kind of thing for her. It's going to the opera at Vancouver with the best of them she ought to be doing. I guess that would suit most young women quite as well as baking bread, but it's a little rough on me that Hetty Ledger would sooner stay right where she is." "What do you mean?" asked Ingleby. "Tom knows," said Tomlinson ruefully. "I haven't put it quite straight to Hetty just now, anyway. It wouldn't be any good. She's quite happy holding on to that blame bakery. Though what she wants to do it for is more than I can figure. It can't be the money, because I've a claim back yonder that's turning out a pile of it every day. She could have all she'd any use for. Ingleby found himself in a position of some perplexity. He could not well admit that there was any reason why an honest man of excellent character, such as Tomlinson appeared to be, should not marry Hetty. And yet the mere probability of this was distasteful to him. It was, in fact, unpleasant to contemplate the possibility of Hetty's marrying anybody. He remembered that she had by no means displayed the satisfaction one would have expected when they found the gold. And from this it appeared that Tomlinson's suggestion that she was quite content to continue the bakery was warranted. It was, however, difficult to discover any reason for this, and he was still considering the question when Ledger came up. Tomlinson turned to him. "You get the thing kind of quiet, told nobody yet?" he said. "Only one of the policemen. We were too busy to spend a good deal of the day coming over to let the boys know, though Ingleby was thinking of going across tonight. You have a good claim already, and you can't hold more than one, you know." Tomlinson nodded. "That's quite right," he said. "It's kind of unfortunate Sewell isn't here. You don't know where he is?" "No," said Ingleby. "He's been away for 2 days looking for a deer. I suppose anybody pegging off a claim next to ours would strike gold." "It's quite likely. He'd get color, sure, but when the creek that washed the metal out was running, it dropped the heavy stuff only here and there. Anyway, chances would be good enough, I figure." "What policeman was it you told?"
"Probin."
Tomlinson's face hardened suddenly. "Oh, yes," he said. "He's quite often hanging around here." It occurred to Ingleby now that the trooper in question had certainly found occasion to visit their mine or the bakery somewhat frequently. But just then the lad in question appeared and came up to them. He disregarded Tomlinson, who showed no sign of recognizing him, and looked at Ingleby. "Major Goldhurst would be glad if you and Ledger could find it convenient to see him now," he said. "What does he want?" asked Ledger sharply. "I don't know," said the trooper. "I'm telling you what he said." There was a curious silence for a moment or two, and Ingleby felt a little thrill of apprehension run through him. Then Tomlinson rose with sudden abruptness. "I guess you've got to go. I'm coming along," he said. "The recorder did not mention you. If he'd been anxious for your company, he probably would have done so," said the trooper dryly. Tomlinson looked at him with a little glint in his eyes and then laid his hand on Ingleby's shoulder. "I've played this game quite a long while, and I guess I know the pointers most as well as anybody," he said. Ingleby said nothing. But his face became suddenly intent, and though the pace they made was fast, he grew feverishly impatient as they swung along the trail to the gold commissioner's office. Colthurst was awaiting them when they reached it and glanced at Tomlinson inquiringly. "You have some business with me?" he said. Tomlinson sat down uninvited with a smile. "Well," he said, "the fact is I don't quite know yet. When you've trouble with the Crown folks in the cities, you can take a lawyer along. At this game, I'm most as good as won." Colthurst made his indifference apparent by a gesture. "I don't suppose it matters. Will you sit down, Mr. Ledger? There's a seat yonder, Ingleby." Ingleby sat down and, with a sinking heart, watched him open a book. There was a difference in Colthurst's manner. He was precise and formal, and did not appear quite comfortable. One could almost have fancied that what he was about to do was distasteful to him. "You left your claim on or about the 20th of June, Ingleby," he said. "You did not return until..." "Hold on," said Tomlinson. "You've got to prove that. I guess there's no reason why you should admit anything, Walter."
Just then there were footsteps outside, and Ingleby looked up sharply as Esmond came in. He appeared a trifle disconcerted when he saw what was going on and turned towards the door again.
"I didn't know you were busy, sir," he said.
"Sit down," and the major's tone was very dry. "I should prefer you to hear this affair with me. You remember on what day Mr. Ingleby left his claim?"
Tomlinson nodded. "That's the straight thing, Major," he said. "Keep him right there. I guess the insect's at the bottom of everything."
"We can dispense with your advice," said Colthurst chillingly, though there was a suggestion of a twinkle in his eyes. In the meantime, Ingleby looked at Esmond, and his face was a trifle pale, though a faint tinge of darker hue showed in the young officer's cheek. He was apparently not altogether free from embarrassment. It was Ingleby who spoke.
"I have no doubt Captain Esmond remembers exactly when I left the claim, sir, and there is nothing to be gained by disputing over a day or two," he said. "I was away a good deal longer than the 72 hours the law permits."
"Which invalidates your title," said the major. "You failed to notify me or claim the privilege, which under certain conditions I might have accorded you."
Ingleby, who had been anxious hitherto, but by no means dismayed, gasped.
"If I understand the regulations, it would be quite sufficient to leave another miner to carry on the work on my account. Besides, under the mineral claim enactments, which I think apply, the title would in any case revert to my partner."
Esmond, who appeared to have recovered his tranquility, smiled a little, and there was a curious silence in the room as Colthurst took down a book. Ingleby could feel his heart throbbing as he listened to the sharp rustle of the leaves while the major looked for the clause he wanted.
"You hold a free miner's certificate, Ledger?" he asked.
"Yes, sir," said Ledger, and then started visibly, while Ingleby, who saw his face, closed one hand a trifle as he leaned forward in his chair.
"You can produce it," said the major.
Ledger dejectedly passed the paper across to him, but Ingleby, who found the suspense becoming unendurable, turned to him.
"Tom," he said hoarsely, "you didn't neglect to renew it."
Ledger did not seem to remember that anybody else was there. He smiled wryly and made a little gesture.
"I'm afraid I did," he said. "I hadn't the money when the time came round. I didn't want you to know that, and I couldn't ask Hetty. We scarcely expected to find anything, you see, and afterwards, I suppose it slipped my memory."
Ingleby said nothing, though his face was very grim, and the little thud of Colthurst's hand upon the book broke sharply through the silence.
"Should a free miner neglect to renew his certificate upon expiry, all minor claims held by him under it revert to the crown," he said. Then he stood up straight and burly, though his face was a trifle flushed. "I'm sorry, Ingleby, but I'm afraid you have thrown away your claim."
Ingleby sat very still for part of a minute, with one hand closed tightly. Then he also rose.
"I can't blame you, sir," he said hoarsely. "I don't think there is anything to be gained by protesting."
"Well," said Tomlinson, "you're way more patient than I would be. Why'd they let you go on working until you'd found the gold?"
Ingleby turned and looked at the police officer with a very unpleasant glint in his eyes.
"That," he said, "is a little kindness for which I fancy I am indebted to Captain Esmond."
He would have gone out, but Tomlinson laid a hand upon his arm and turned to the recorder.
"Now," he said, "I'm going to do some talking. That claim's Ingleby's, Major, until you've declared it open and wiped out his record."
"Well," said Colthurst dryly, "I am sorry to find myself compelled to do it. The claim lately held by Walter Ingleby and Thomas Ledger, having reverted to the crown, is open for relocation. a notice will be issued to that effect. I may, however, point out to you that no free miner can hold more than one claim in the same vicinity."
"That's all right," said Tomlinson. "The one I've got is quite enough for me."
"You have a certificate, Ingleby?"
"Take out a new one, Ledger."
Ledger drew the little bag from his pocket, but Tomlinson waved it aside and threw another down before Colthurst, glancing at Esmond as he did so.
"That gold came out of the reverted mine. They might claim it wasn't yours."
"We'll make sure," he said.
"There's a man worth keeping your eye on who has a hand in this deal."
"More than the necessary amount there, sir. Let him have his certificate. I'll look for the rest any time that it suits you."
Colthurst's eyes twinkled a little as comprehension dawned on him, and he passed Ledger the paper.
"I fancy any advice that Prospector Tomlinson desires to give you would be worth considering," he said.
Tomlinson wasted no further time, but drove Ingleby and Ledger before him out of the room.
"It's Russell now," he said. "There's nothing to stop either of you pegging a new claim down on the lead alongside the old one. There's even chances you'll strike it quite as rich there. Get your stakes in."
"Where are you going?" asked Ledger.
Tomlinson laughed.
"To put the boys on the lead. Still, it's quite likely that a friend of mine will relocate your old claim a little ahead of them. He'll be there most as soon as the major puts up his notice that it's open. He may think it worthwhile to let me in somehow for telling him."
He set off at a run, and as he disappeared, Ingleby and Ledger, leaving the winding trail, went straight through the undergrowth towards the canyon. Vigorous movement with a definite purpose was a relief to them, and they were gasping and dripping with perspiration when at last they stopped beside the sequestrated claim. Nobody else had reached it, and the bush was very still, but it was in feverish haste. They hewed and drove in certain square-faced stakes. They were still on the lead, and once more a little hope sprang up in them. In the meanwhile, Colthurst sat at his table looking hard at Esmond.
"I hope," he said grimly, "that you are now satisfied."
Esmond met his gaze without embarrassment.
"I'm not sure I quite catch your meaning, sir."
"In that case," said Colthurst, "it is a trifle difficult to understand how you came to hold a commission in a service in which one understands intelligence is necessary. I have carried out the law, but I don't mind admitting that I do not appreciate being made use of in this fashion. It is very evident you do not like Ingleby."
Esmond, who made no disclaimer, appeared to reflect for a moment or two.
"Well," he said, "you have perhaps some ground for feeling aggrieved, sir, but I can't help thinking that I have done nothing that was unnecessary. I am not blaming you for doing your duty."
"I scarcely think you would be warranted in considering me very much at fault for going a little beyond it. I admit it would please me to see Ingleby driven out of the valley. The fellow's presumption is almost insufferable."
Colthurst glanced at him sharply, and his face grew a trifle red.
"Ingleby is very young in comparison with myself, but you were once good enough to allude to him as a friend of mine, and you certainly met him at my house as my guest. If there was any particular meaning in your speech, it would be better to come straight to the point. I don't like hints."
"I can only offer you my excuses for momentary bad memory, sir. Absurd as it may seem to you, I'm far from sure that Ingleby is likely to be content with the status mentioned. A very little reflection should make the warning clear. In the meanwhile, I have a couple of troopers waiting for me."
He went out, and Colthurst sat still at his table, gazing vacantly in front of him with his lips unusually firmly set. Then he rose with a little shake of his shoulders and a gesture of relief.
"The thing is quite out of the question. Grace has too much sense," he said.
Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaws.